Hello, everyone, and welcome to our next hit of World Rugby's Between the Lines series. We've had some of the biggest names in the sport join us over, well, the last few months, and they just keep getting bigger and better and bigger and better. Tonight it is Matt Gitto joining us from Australia's capital. Gits, how you doing?
Good, mate. How are you?
I was going to rattle through all your achievements, but you're not kind of about that. But I'm going to have to tip into them. Over 100 Wallabies caps, 100 Super Rugby games, Champions Cups, the whole box and dice. And the problem with that, it makes me wonder, how do we kick this conversation off? How do we have this Between the Lines chat? Where do you normally start when people touch on your career?
Like you said, I don't really like to talk about it. I think the one thing that doesn't get mentioned, but probably should, is I'm a dual Guinness World Records holder.
Okay, now we're talking. Let's run through that. Let's sink our teeth into that and go from there.
Yeah, right. So I don't know what year it was, but anyway, when we were in France, Drew Mitchell decided to put his New Year's resolution. He wanted to achieve a Guinness World Record. So the people from BBC came across, they put his nomination forward, they paid his fee just so they could film it. And I was just fortunate that for one of them, I had to pass in the rugby, the most drop goals you can kick in 2 minutes or a minute. Because I passed in the ball, I got an award for that. And we also, I think we got the most passes over a 5 meter distance in a minute. So they're my two records, but Drew had ones like crushing apples in his bicep, the quickest 100 metres in clogs, I think, which has now been broken.
Yeah.
I think he doesn't hold it anymore. But that's, I think, my greatest achievement.
What was the number of drop goals that Drew Mitchell knocked over with you passing to him? Can you remember how many there were?
Yeah, I think 27, but you had to, like, 25 was the cutoff. So I think
there
could have even been 3 minutes. He was shanking him left, right. Like, it got pretty tight. And it's a pretty easy record to get.
Yeah, and he's got the clog racing, but you're there with him on the drop goal front. Mate, that's a perfect lead into your time in Toulon. Obviously, you bounced out of Australia 2011 and made France home. Take me back to the early days of Toulon. I'm told that for you to join the Toulon squad, someone has to vouch for you to join that setup, or that was the case back in the day. Who vouched for you?
Matt Henjak, who I played with at the Force. He's a Canberra boy as well. He was over at Toulon when Philippe Saint-André was the coach at the time, and he signed me. There must have been, as there often is, some trouble with the French national team. Philippe Saint-André then was the head coach. We recruited Bernard Laporte, who actually didn't want to sign me. So it was an awkward start for me.
But it started and it went well from there. Run us back through some of those early days, because the squads, when you look back, it's like a barbarian setup those days of Toulon when you were initially there. Some of the guys that you got to play alongside, what were you thinking when you joined the red and black in that part of the world?
Well, I was between Toulon or Stade Francais, because Michael Checker was the Stade Francais coach. So when I first got to Toulon, I don't know. I think it's a bit of a older town, I suppose. So when I first got there, I was like, oh, this isn't as nice as I thought it would be, because I was in the actual city, not around where the beaches were. So I was kind of regretting not going to Stud at that time. But yeah, I mean, the players that were with, it was almost like your first day of school. Like, you, these new guys, for me, I'd just been dropped from the national team. So there was a little bit of, like, embarrassment, I suppose, I carried with me a little bit. Like I know you guys assigned me, but I still can't even play for my national team, a little bit with what was going through my head. So I just head down, just worked hard, tried as hard as I could to learn French as much as I could, and just embrace the culture, because I think that's the quickest way to get the locals behind you, is to show how much you love their country and that you're not just there for cash, you're there to try as hard as you can and win something.
Give us some idea as to how passionate they are about rugby in that part of France, especially when they're winning like you guys were.
When you're winning, yeah, it's good. You got the keys to the city, pretty much, like really the keys to the city. You can go to bars, you can pour your own drinks, you can leave things open later. Or I remember being one time just down at the beachside bar near where we live, having a drink, and my kids were running, I could see them. A supporter came up and asked these like responsible kids, asked if he could babysit the kids and watch them. Like it was a bit of a privilege for him. So little things like that, it just made living in France so comfortable. And it was really, really good. But then on the flip side, when you're not winning, they tell you what they think, what went wrong, who didn't give 100%. It could have been me. They said, I didn't think you played well. And you've got to cop that.
Champions Cup, when you jagged those two, what was the reaction back in town when you managed to land the biggest prize in Europe?
Was actually an interesting story, that one. We won the Champions Cup the first time, I think it was in Ireland, Aviva Stadium. But we had a semi-final for top 14 the next week. So we couldn't go back to Toulon. But our owner doesn't like the limelight. He got the private plane back and lifted the trophy off. I think it was, 50,000 people turned up. But a week or two later, after we lost the final, we had an actual parade around the city. And I think we had like 70,000 people there. And the population's only 110. So it's like everyone loves it and they live for it. So I suppose it reinforced how special it is and how much we're always on show and we need to perform for, for the town.
It's insane how many big name players were there with you in Toulon. Which of those players did you learn most off on the field, and who did you learn most off it?
I think off it, I still even learn to this day off Drew Mitchell. He's got a lot to teach off the field. On the field, I don't think it'd really be fair to say one player, but there's just because there were so many stars, they all had something that they were brilliant at, like one thing that they were just really brilliant at. And I'd try and just pick parts of that consistently off different guys. So that was a luxury of having so many great players. And I suppose the biggest thing that I learned off those guys, off them, rather than except for Johnny, would be the ability that if you prepared well throughout the week, you could really relax on game day. I think before I went to France, I used to just lock myself up in the hotel, not say too much before the big games, and just keep to myself, feeling that I needed to keep preparing. I learned at Toulon that if you do the work for the front half of the week, your Monday to Wednesday, then the back half in the game will take care of itself.
And you mentioned Johnny, so he was a little different. He was just always on, was he? All the way through to the final whistle on the Saturday afternoon.
If we didn't have a field that he could kick to, because sometimes when you play, say, in Brive or these smaller towns, you don't have a park you can go and do your little game day walkthrough or a post to kick at. He'd be goal-kicking in the car park, kicking along the driveway, having him caught by our translator. But I remember one time I asked him, I said, why don't you just have this captain's run off, go into the game fresh? Because it wasn't a big game for us, so he could afford to experiment a little bit. And he just said he couldn't. He said, if I don't do the work and do this repetitively, perfectly, and know each part of my game is perfect, then I won't sleep well. And before the game, I just won't have that confidence. Which for me, I thought was, I couldn't get my head around it, because this guy was also the guy that kicked a field goal with his wrong foot to beat us in a World Cup final. I just couldn't understand that he didn't have the self-confidence and belief to maybe take a day off. But it's just probably what made him so good. Well, it obviously was made him so good.
Was there anyone else that mirrored that kind of approach that you played alongside? Anyone else that had that attitude?
No one. No one. Not that particular and intense every day. Like every day practicing your basic skills. Yeah, it was. And the mental strength it would have taken to do that. Because sometimes you feel just a little bit flat, and he was even feeling his ankle sore one day, and I said, I just have this week off. I said, I can play 10. He said, no, because I'm supposed to play this week. And then after that, this is meant to be, I'm supposed to play this week. He'll just get in it.
Mate, that's unbelievable. So he wins that World Cup in 2003. Obviously, you played in that one, 07-2, no 2011. You mentioned just before that you felt embarrassed not having played for Australia anymore, but in a roundabout way, it kind of worked out well because you were reeled in for that 2015 run in the UK. because this is a World Rugby podcast, we can watch as much vision as we'd like on the way through to recap a lot of what you achieved in Wallabies colours. Take us back to 2015 and put us on that ride that had you in the final game of the tournament.
Yeah, it was unreal. Everything panned out perfectly. Going back to the Wallabies, the early Four Nations, or what was it called, the Rugby Championship, winning that, mm-hmm. Then leading into the prep, going over to Notre Dame. Everything was just seamless transition. But, you know, behind the scenes, before we went over, there was a lot of doubt, a lot of questions whether I could play at that level again, a lot of nights where I'd be looking at how I played, trying to work out whether I'd do the same things. So a lot of work that went into it, but that I accepted the last game. It was unreal. Everything went perfect for me. The group was great. Having Drew there made a big difference because initially, I mean, you might not believe me, but I'm a bit more of a shy guy, a bit more reserved until I get to know people, and then I'm probably the other way, over the top. But having Drew there, he broke down the barriers. He's really good coming into groups. He's happy to be loud at the start, so it allowed me to meet the guys and just sit back and find my little comfort zone, and that probably helped my rugby as well.
A little Jonalomu rugby in the team hotel just to take the edge off. Yeah, I'm told that you was, absolutely flogged him every time you played. I'm told that every time that you fired up the controllers, you destroyed him in Jonalomu rugby.
Well, because he didn't really know how to shunt. You know, when they come to tackle you and you just do that little shunt move. Yeah. And no one, he doesn't know how to shunt. Yeah. So it was pretty easy. But it was just good. Even those things, the memories, the hotel, everything.
One of the games that obviously would be really, really memorable for you is that win against England that you were instrumental in. What are your recollections around that particular game?
Well, I remember the game plan being we need to start fast, cause a little bit of doubt, because as much as they were leading and they probably should have beaten Wales, though now they'd lost their game against Wales, a home World Cup. They needed to beat us to make through to the final stages. So if we started well, we're going to put a lot of doubt in their minds. And luckily for us, the first two plays that we practice all week, which rarely every training move that you do, you probably get one out of four that will work perfectly. Our first two worked perfectly and we're up 14-0. And then off the back of that, we could just defend and put more pressure on them because of the scoreboard pressure. So, yeah, I remember all that really clearly. It was, again, another perfect scenario, great start for us. Yeah, there's nothing really I could say that was bad about any part of that World Cup. I would have loved to have won a World Cup and won the final, but I think, you know, probably the team that had been the best team for the last 8 years won the World Cup. So they'll probably, you know, as much as I would like to say we were deserving winners, they were deserving, you know, to get the title.
What about the quarterfinal against Scotland? It still gets spoken about. I interviewed Craig Joubert here a couple of weeks back. I couldn't bring myself to bring it up with him, but it just sort of still sits there. What is your recollection of that knockout match against the Scots?
Well, I think everyone talks about that penalty at the end. You know, it was pretty decisive, I think, as far as the game goes. But I think the Scottish certainly can't have a bad bone against me, so I can say it, because in 2009 I missed an easy kick to allow the Scottish to get their first win over us in however long. So I'm going to say this. But I think in that final, that quarter, we maybe had two or three tries disallowed, which I thought were pretty questionable. And I think I'm a firm believer that in sport, I think in life also, you know, you kind of get what you deserve. And I think we were deserved to go through to the semis and all the way to the final. And I think for a large part of that game, we probably were in control and were unlucky with a couple of those disallowed tries. So whether it was a penalty or not, probably not. But I don't know anything about scrums. We'll take it. And I think the win was probably one that we were owed.
Spinning it forward 4 years, you're in Japan. You've obviously spent a lot of time with Suntory there on the club front, but you're there last year as an ambassador with Saite, and you get to see firsthand the way Japan, a country you've been playing inside for a long time, embraces a World Cup. What was your impression of how the Japanese handled the World Cup last year?
Unbelievable. And post-World Cup, I think the year before, most of our games, we'd get 2,000 to 3,000 people to a game. After the World Cup, we were getting 20,000 sold out stadiums to every top league game. So I think the way that they use that momentum from how well they played, the Japan rugby, they've kept the sport popular, and a lot of people were embracing it. So yeah, it was really good. That was a great tournament. And it's the first time that I've been there as a spectator and to witness actually how big an event it is, because as a player, you often go to stadiums and play in front of a lot of people. So you kind of miss the whole spectacle of a World Cup. But just to be the opening ceremony and see how big it is on the world stage, I think it was a bit lost on me as a player.
Yeah, no, it was awesome. What was your favourite moment of that tournament?
The favourite moment of that tournament. It's hard to go past the Japanese rugby team. I think what they did, that was that game against Scotland, especially from all the problems that they went through beforehand to get the game. They were going to call it off, and then Scotland weren't going to make the finals. So then there was like a lot of legal work as well to actually get that game to happen and them to make it on their own merits and by winning the games properly. Yeah, that was a pretty good story, I think. And obviously, you know, South Africa winning again was big. England beating New Zealand, that was probably the best game of rugby that I saw, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it takes some beating. Hey, mate, we normally finish off these chats with a range of questions that we've had crafted for each of our different guests, but I took it a different direction tonight. I had some of your former teammates help me with some of the questions. The first one is from Drew Mitchell. It's more of a statement than I guess it is a question. He simply says, remember that time that we shared the Queen's Martini? Do you want to elaborate on that at all for us?
Yeah, I'm happy to. We're at Buckingham Palace and the Queen will come in. She's always got her server that'll hold the drink, and she had a little sip, and then she walks around and greets everyone. Hi, yeah, how you doing? Small talk. She's the queen of small talk. He put the drink down and he turned the other way, and Drew said, I'm going to have a drink. Drew, don't. I said, there's cameras here. The last, you can't have a drink. Don't have a drink. He said, I'm going to do it. Cover me. So then I've just like shielded a little bit, making sure that she's talking. The security were busy. And Drew's just had a sip. He's come back. He's gone, oh. He said, mate, that's straight gin. I was like, really? Anyway, then he's there shielded for me, and we've had a sip. And that's what she does. No wonder she loves it. Small talk. You couldn't have water, but it just looks like a glass of water. But she's knocking back the gins.
He tells a story very differently. He gave it to us the other night when we were doing the Aussie Rugby Show. But you'll have to check in to see his version to counter your version, how that all went down. Stephen Hoyles tells me that your training regime was unlike anything else he'd seen, but you rarely speak about it. He reckons you used to flog yourself when it came to training. I guess that's potentially, is that how it played out? And is that what you would instill in other kids as well?
Yeah. Yeah, I think work ethic's obviously something that I try and pride myself on. So yeah, I'm training. I set myself a schedule each week where I get my fitness, my speed, my weight done. Just, I don't know, a creature of, I think I can enjoy myself more if I flog myself. And throughout the teams that I've been in, all the best players that have been around for a long time, I think have been the ones that have worked hard. You know, ones at Cruise, they're really good for a couple of years, but the ones that have been around for a long time, they're generally closet trainers. They're the ones that behind closed doors won't talk about it, but they work pretty hard.
Another one from the same group. What was your favourite win as a Wallaby?
Wow. I think probably 2004 we beat England at Twickenham. And it was Elton Flatley got injured early. Stephen Larkham was on the coaching panel that week because he got injured the week before. So I moved to 5'8". And it was probably the first game of Test rugby that I played with some sort of control and dominance compared to the way I was in Super Rugby. And with Eddie Jones, that was his biggest mate. You know, it's Super Rugby, it's great. I need to see that dominance in Test rugby, mate. So that was always something that I was trying to – I never really felt like I belonged at Test rugby until after that game when we won. I kicked well, played Johnny, I think I swapped jerseys with Johnny that game, so, or maybe he was injured, I'm not sure, but yeah, it was that was probably the most comforting win as far as made me feel like, okay, I belong on this level.
The next one sort of centers more around some of the impersonation you just delivered around Eddie Jones. Who gives a better Eddie Jones impersonation, yourself or Morgan Tirunui?
I haven't seen Morgs do it publicly. Like, privately is very different to giving one publicly. I got a text the other day. Eddie got the message. I got one of the podcasts. I did one for James Haskell and
The House of Rugby one.
Rugby,
yeah.
Joe, I think it is. The House of Rugby, yeah.
Yeah.
And he said, "Oh, nice impression, mate." He said, "We'll have to have a beer and talk about it." And I just know that means he's just going to sit there and work me over. But yeah, I mean, I haven't seen Morgs all publicly. That's the challenge.
Yeah, right. I gotcha. Gotcha. Well, if we keep poking him, we might get we can have a square off you v Morgan Tirunui on the Eddie Jones front. Mate, one of the other ones that we kind of like to throw up, and this is a really good one. You've got two youngsters. You've got another one arriving in the next day or so. The kids are playing up and you say, right, come here. You're going to sit in the pool room and I'm going to put one of my highlights on repeat for an entire day to punish you. What highlight would it be? It's a Matt Giddo highlight. Which is it?
Gee, there's not many floating around my head, to be honest.
You've only got 200 professional games to call from across Super and Wallabies.
I mean, I don't think it'd be a punishment because I'd sit down, I'd watch it with them. I think, I don't know what I'd do. That's a tough question, that one, because I don't know. There's nothing I really think of. Even when I think of a highlight, I think it may be something that I could have done better in that game. It's a bit of an anticlimax, bit of a downer. But yeah,
you've got to have a moment that you can have over again.
Yeah, maybe against South Africa, I'd just come back from an injury, and it was like my first touch. I got a short ball off Mark Gerrard. Stepped, Monty was the fullback, and then I did a swan dive, 2006, I think it was. Maybe that was the one, because I had a couple of doubts about my knee going into that game.
Okay, that'll work from 06. Okay, tell us what's happening next for you in when COVID goes out the back door. Where will we see Matt Giddo next before we say goodbye?
I'm kind of going through that transition now, so just trying to keep busy, kind of train and keep my mind and body active. But I'm going into that transitioning phase now. So I'm just trying to find something that I'm passionate about, something that gives me purpose like rugby did.
Will we see you with a coach's clipboard anytime soon?
I don't know if I'll need a clipboard. You know, for me, I'd love to get involved and help the younger generation or the people coming through any way I can. But from a sit-down review each week, setting the team up coaching point of view, at this stage I couldn't see that happening. But if it's a skills mentor type role, then I'd love to do something like that.
Well, hopefully we see you not lost to rugby, mate. You've given so much over such a long period of time now, Australia, worldwide, Japan, France, the whole box and dice. And mate, lastly, good luck with the arrival of the next little bundle. Hope all goes well for you.
Thanks, mate. Yeah, fingers crossed.
Yep, how good to spend some time there with Wallabies legend Matt Giddo. And don't forget, if watching these interviews is more your style, then that's easy as well. You just need to head to World Rugby's YouTube page. Alternatively, you can hit up World Rugby's Instagram page and check them all out via IGTV. Righto, that's a wrap. We'll be back again next week with another huge name from the world of rugby.